Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. And in this episode, we are again talking about incretin therapies, GLP-1 agonists, but specifically some new data with semaglutide and HFpEF, what we call heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And there was recently a new publication in the New England Journal of Medicine where semaglutide was specifically studied in people with type 2 diabetes with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So before we even go into that, I wanted to just do a quick recap. So in the past, we talked about the original publication, which was done in people without diabetes, but they did have obesity. And this was published last November. And in this study, they basically randomized people either to semaglutide or to placebo. And the primary outcome was actually they were looking at this change in the KCCQ-CSS. What does that stand for? That's the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire. So basically, it's symptomatic how were symptoms. And then there were a bunch of secondary endpoints that were looked at as well, like quality of life, weight loss, the BNP value, a bunch of other features that they looked at. And so bottom line from this trial that was done in people with obesity was there was a significant difference in terms of improvement in that score, where the change was much greater in people that were taking semaglutide, so much better symptom improvement. And then also, not surprisingly, there was much more weight loss. There was a 13.3% weight loss in that group versus 2.6 in the placebo group. And there were a number of other positive things like changes in their 6-minute walk distance. There were reduction in hospitalizations for urgent visits for heart failure. And so with that kind of brief summary, Natalie, I'm hoping you can next talk about, well, what did the data look like in this new publication for people that had type 2 diabetes with HFpEF?
Yeah, so we look at the first study back, you know, in the fall, and now we're looking at semaglutide in patients with obesity-related heart failure and type 2 diabetes. Because we really do need to remember that that weight loss with people using semaglutide with and without diabetes, all of these different things, they have different effects with people with and without obesity. So there was a new trial, obesity and type 2 diabetes, right? Randomly assigned patients who had heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction, a BMI greater than what? 30, because that's diagnostic of obesity, right? Or more type 2 diabetes to receive semaglutide at the 2.4 milligram dose or placebo for 52 weeks. The endpoints were change in baseline from, again, what is this? This Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire. And why is this important? Because people with heart failure, they struggle to move. They struggle. They're out of breath. They don't feel well. They're exhausted. So looking at a questionnaire that says, are you able to move more? Are you less out of breath? Are you less exhausted? This is a really important part of their lives. And there's a lot of depression that goes with this. There's a lot of, you know, and if you can't move, you gain weight, you eat because you're upset and depressed. It kind of like, you know, snowballs, doesn't it? So secondary endpoints included a change in the six-minute walk distance. Why is this important? Because people with heart failure that can still move do better overall than people that can't move anymore. And then there was a hierarchical composite endpoint that included death, heart failure events, and differences in the change from that Kansas City score and 6-minute walk distance, and the change in the C-reactive protein level. Remember, C-reactive protein level changes all the time. Right? In somebody, it could change 3 different times a day if you draw it. But what we can look at overall is we're looking for, because we believe that and we know that GLP-1s reduce inflammation. So those are the big things that they looked for in this trial. Randomized a total of 616 participants. And ultimately, patients with obesity-related heart failure with this preserved ejection fraction in type 2 diabetes led to larger reductions in heart failure related symptoms, physical limitations. They had more weight loss than the placebo at 1 year. And what does this tell us? What this tells us is we started using GLP-1s to manage what? Diabetes. And in the last handful of years, we're using it to do other things. We never thought semaglutide or any GLP-1 could do anything for heart failure, could do anything for, you know, we just talked about recently on another podcast, the FLOW trial, where we got top line results that said, you know, it improves, you know, and reduces that renal progression to needing dialysis, right? This is another study that is saying that these outcomes are impressive for a GLP-1 when we never thought they would happen. So that change in that Kansas City score went from 13.7 versus 6.4. That's significant. And the change in body weight was minus 9.8% versus minus 3.8%. So, you know, I think this is important. Time to first heart failure event, 7 versus 18. And all-cause mortality, 1.9 versus 3.3. So I'm excited about this. And it helps guide our practice to when do we, how do we add these and look at the guidelines? What do the guidelines say? The guidelines say if you have an increased risk of cardiovascular, you have an increased cardiovascular risk, we should be using these agents earlier. And this study tells us, yes, you should, right? It actually builds up on the evidence of using them earlier in the disease process versus later. Diana, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm really curious how the guidelines are going to change based on this, because already, even based on the original trial back in November, it was like, wow, the GLP-1 agonists have benefit in heart failure, at least with preserved ejection fraction. So historically, it's always been heart failure, use an SGLT2 inhibitor. But now it really puts into question, should we be using this? Should we be using both? Kind of like what we have for established cardiovascular disease, you can use either one. And right. I think this really solidifies that, because with the previous trial, it didn't include people with diabetes. So we couldn't really say how that applies to people with diabetes. I think we all expected this result, that why would people with type 2 diabetes not respond? But it's good to see that they do respond well. And so I'm really curious now. One of the things that's interesting is I think only like a third of patients were on SGLT2 inhibitors. So that is interesting, right? Because you'd expect maybe more would have been on SGLT2 inhibitors if they had heart failure. So I am kind of curious, I guess, you know, we don't know, I guess, which one is better versus the other, because they haven't been compared head to head. So that part is kind of interesting, why more weren't maybe on the SGLT2 inhibitor at baseline.
And I will say that in the recent past, we are seeing more and more people coming, especially from nephrology, already on, or cardiology, on an SGLT2 inhibitor. And so I think that if we looked at this data from the same number of people in the next few years, we'd see more and more people using SGLT2 inhibitors. You know, I will say too, there was weight loss in this trial specifically was lower than with the first trial that we reviewed. It's hard to directly come across, you know, you can't compare trial to trial, just like you can't compare drug to drug, because they're designed a little bit different in all those things, right? But that could be the reason why, because in this trial, more people were using SGLT2 inhibitors. And remember, it's pulling out glucose from those nephrons, right, every day. And so there is weight loss with the SGLT2 inhibitor class. So that may have been the difference in the weight loss all by itself. But again, we don't know for sure.
Right. So yeah, it'll be interesting. And of course, we don't have data in terms of, this was preserved ejection fraction, not reduced ejection fraction.
Right.
So I think in that condition, the SGLT2 inhibitors are still, we've got the evidence backing them up for that. So that kind of, there was also, we love New England Journal of Medicine. That's where both of these were published, both of these studies. But also there was a recent editorial about equitable access for these agents. And so I think, you know, we could keep hearing more and more about the benefits. And it's great, right? Like, we should put these in the water. We should give them to everyone, except wait, they are, at least in the US, they're around $1,000 a month. In other countries, they're a little bit less. But even where they're less money, there are shortages that we know. There's shortages around the world right now where certain doses we can't keep in stock. And so it just, there's no way, at least not in the present moment, that we could put every single person that might have an indication of whether it's diabetes or obesity or heart failure. Like, there's just no way. So how do we decide who should get these? And that's what this editorial was really kind of getting at. Like, what do we do? So Natalie, I'm curious your thoughts on this.
This is such a hard one because, you know, we just had the readout of semaglutide reducing the risk of cardiovascular events in people without diabetes by 20%. So, you know, we go back and forth saying, well, do we give it first to the people with diabetes? Do we give it first to the people, you know, that have obesity? And I think that we're going to have a shortage for a while, right? I mean, right now, I can't get some of them. I can't get some of them at different doses. But also cost is a big deal. So people who have a high deductible plan, those are the people that have the biggest struggle, right? Because they have got this huge deductible to pay before they can do anything else. We've got to make decisions. And clinically, you know, I think that the fair allocation is saying the first thing we do is benefit the people, limit the harm. And that involves that the people with diabetes probably have a higher risk than those without diabetes for those major adverse cardiac events. And do we use those first? The challenge with that whole discussion is that we can't make the drugs, right? So all of the weight loss GLP-1s and all of the diabetes GLP-1s are made and marketed under different names. So semaglutide has a diabetes name and it has a weight loss name. Tirzepatide has a diabetes name and a weight loss name. So you can't really mix and match, even though you could, because it's the same molecule. Because if I have diabetes, it's easier for me to get someone the diabetes indication than it is for the weight loss indication. So it's very hard to mix and match. And we almost never do that. We almost don't ever say, they're out of tirzepatide diabetes. Let me see if I can get you weight loss, right? The copays are different. The benefit packages are different. It's a nightmare. So with that being said, then am I really picking between choosing people with diabetes and then not giving it to people who have overweight or obesity, because the drug is there and we can use it? And who am I to decide that your BMI is only 42, so I should give it to the 47s? Because I just don't know that that's a decision that I should be making. And then on top of it all, people who has coverage and who doesn't is another whole discussion.
At least in the US, the people that have money or have really good insurance
can buy
or
it.
Both.
Yep.
They're the ones that are going to get it. So it's likely not going to be equitable, at least with our current healthcare model. But it's really interesting in this like perspective, the kind of the hierarchy, like you were saying, like initially, okay, people with type 2 diabetes, but also like they say, all right, number one, like we want to minimize potential years of life lost by preventing excess and premature death. So that would be people with class 3 obesity, so the BMI over 40, and people with severe type 2 diabetes, which they say A1C over 8%, who have not responded to alternative treatment, which then is this whole gray area, like how many other things do you have to try?
Right, and what treatments did you try, right? Like if I give you insulin right away, you will respond, but that might not be the greatest drug for you.
Right.
Right?
And so, that like, yeah.
Yeah.
And that phase one should be younger people under 50. And then phase two would be older people. Okay. Which is also its whole own moral dilemma. Right. But then two would be prevent imminent medical complications such as cardiovascular events. So that's where they include people with class 2 obesity, BMI 35 to just under 40, followed by people with severe type 2 diabetes. Again, they say A1C greater than 8%, and then phase one younger and phase two older. So,
right.
And then
I think this is hard because you and I can keep picking different things where a person might not fit, that might fit into one category, but we might want to, right. But at least, I guess the thing is that they've stratified it to give us at least a guideline to think about. Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. So I guess in the first one, it's people with both obesity and type 2 that's not responsive. And the second one, it's people with obesity followed by severe type 2 diabetes. And then number 3 is just preventing future medical complications. So that would be people with class 1, so BMI 30 to under 35, followed by type 2 diabetes with an A1C over 7% who haven't responded. And then 4 is kind of that tier of improved quality of life and social and emotional health. So that's people with overweight, BMI is 25 to under 30, or type 2 diabetes with A1C greater than 7%, who aren't eligible under another 1, 2, or 3 tier. And then in all of these, it's younger are prioritized over older. But it's interesting because like older would be higher cardiovascular risk and likely to see more of an immediate benefit with these therapies. So,
right.
Like if you're using it for cardiovascular prevention, I mean, you're going to have to use it a really long time to see a benefit in someone that's younger and healthier, but maybe just lives with obesity. So I agree. It's a nice, like it gets us thinking. It's like a good start for a framework. I think that it's a good, like we need to think about this, but the reality, and they call this out in the perspective too, is that with our current health system and how fragmented it is in the US, it's just, even if we all could agree on what guidelines we should follow, how are we actually going to implement it? I mean, if someone comes along and they're like, I have $1,000, my BMI is 30 and I want to take a GLP-1 agonist. I mean,
great,
we're not going to stop them, right? I mean, assuming the pharmacy can get the drug. So it's just going to be tough to implement.
And it will be interesting to see how outside the US this happens too, because with socialized medicine, where, you know, the government is negotiating drug prices, you know, medications are typically overall less expensive, but these are still very expensive. You know, semaglutide 1 milligram available in Canada, is still hundreds of dollars a month, right? Mm. So, for example, only because I had a Canadian in here today as I'm bringing that one up, but the other ones are just as expensive, right? So it's not inexpensive there. It's more than double of that here in the United States. And, you know, I think the other thing we need to remember is people sometimes think, okay, you have to have this like super high-end president of a company kind of job to have good coverage for these in the United States. And that's not true. I have people working in all kinds of different positions, from no formalized above high school education all the way up to PhD, doctorate, you know, everything in between, where you'd be surprised at different levels of coverage. So I think some of it, you know, so do I not give it to someone because they're level 4 versus when they have coverage and it's available? Right. I think that's where you and I kind of get like, yeah, but if it's going to help improve their outcome. And I, the only thing I don't necessarily love is that quality of life and social and emotional health isn't mentioned till number 4. And I would hope
it's that, like, isn't that important?
Quality of life and social emotional health should be mentioned across the tiers of 1, 2, and 3 as well. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, when we use these medications, I've had several people say to me, I just feel better. And we believe that that's that anti-inflammatory effect. They do it right away too. It's not like they lose 10 pounds and then they say, oh my gosh, I feel so much better. I fit into this pair of jeans. It's not that. They're like, no, my depression is better. I just feel better. I wake up feeling better. And those words, doesn't someone with all of those people should have that? So my biggest thing is, quality of life and social emotional health affects diabetes management. So I think we need to put that in every category. That's my biggest, like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Guys, remember
the other thing, that I don't know was mentioned here, but like not all incretin therapies are the same. Clearly right now, semaglutide and tirzepatide they're more potent than the others. Yep. They have more weight loss. They have more, glucose lowering. Semaglutide has certainly demonstrated a lot of cardiovascular benefits. We're still waiting on tirzepatide on the data, but they're They've been amazing, right? That's why we're even having this conversation. Well, what happens when some of the older ones become generic? So thinking about exenatide, which really has not demonstrated, it's been neutral with the cardiovascular data. I guess it depends how you look at it, but also the structure of it is a little bit different than the others. Liraglutide, which has demonstrated cardiovascular benefits, but doesn't have that same kind of powerful punch with the weight loss. So like, what's going to happen then? Those are going to be lower costs. So do we put people on those, even though there's more powerful ones that are more expensive? So there are a lot of ethical dilemmas that come up with this.
I absolutely agree. And I think this is going to, in the next handful of years, really, you know, that we're going to continue this discussion because we're expecting new readouts at ADA. We're expecting readouts at, you know, every major medical conference that has anything to do with diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease. They're all going to be, lots of the readouts are going to be about these agents and future agents and cost, but as much the, you know, that person-centric, who's in front of me, what is their emotional status? That's so important as well. So I think you're right.
It's so important. And one other thing, because like, you know, on an objective level, I'm like, okay, you know, Medicare recently said they were going to cover semaglutide for people that kind of fit that select criteria where they live with overweight or obesity and they have established cardiovascular disease. So I'm like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. Like, that's really fair. They showed a 20% reduction. But then as I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I'm like, well, wait a second. So the person who hasn't had a heart attack, but also has obesity and would like to reduce their cardiovascular risk and lower their weight has to wait until they have a heart attack to qualify for the drug. So that doesn't really seem great either. So
I think the next trial needs to be that it's, you know, that reduction, right? That preventative net, you know, again, we have to keep going back and saying, how do we get to the next level? How do we find the sweet spot where the most people, their lives are, their cardiovascular risk is reduced, their renal, you know, risk is reduced, but also their quality of life goes up and we can afford to do it for all of these people, right? Because it could crash the healthcare system if everyone that has indication for these drugs. I think we should actually interview Earl about this at ADA, about the cost. You know, he did a really good article on if we actually put every single person on it, we'd crash the U.S. healthcare system, which is, I think, why other countries are like, well, we're going to start here. We're going to do this because they actually, there's one balancing of the books. There's not, you know, we have so many different books to balance that no one really could tell you what's going on. Most of us at least couldn't, right? So I think we should continue this conversation with Earl Hirsch again and talk about cost and what he does in his practice. And maybe that's something that we could do at the next big clinical meeting is interview people and say, how do you decide based on this new data?
Right. I think that's a great idea. So yes, looking forward to ADA. And thanks. This was a great discussion. Always love talking about the GLP-1s and the incretins. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And that concludes this episode of Diabetes Dialogue. We hope you'll join us again next time.
Thanks, everyone.